long delayed it may have been, but there were no half measures about the advance of the Peloponnesians from their bunghole when it came. Making good their demolition work of the previous summer, engineers had already repaired the land route to Megara, and it was just as well that they had not botched their responsibility. For the Isthmus Road, shuddering under thousands of tramping feet, had never before had to bear the weight of such an army. Indeed, a Greek expeditionary force to rival it had not been seen since the fabled times of the Trojan War. From Corinth to Mycenae, from Tegea to Trazon, an immense coalition of Peloponnesians had answered the Spartans' call. Naturally, the Spartans themselves, 5,000 of them, almost three-quarters of their city's total manpower, provided the task force with its most menacing spear thrust. With 5,000 further hoplites recruited from the outlying townships of Lacedaemon, and thousands of helots rounded up to serve as batmen and light infantry, it was almost certainly the largest army that Sparta had ever committed to the field. Cleombrotus, Leonidas's younger brother, had been serving ably as regent, but he too, during the course of the winter, had died. When the Spartans then, having resolved to give battle at last, marched out from the isthmus, they did so under the generalship of a young man barely in his 20s, Pausanias, the son of Cleombrotus. Since he was, as the regent of Sparta, also the supreme commander of the allied forces, this was a startling weight of responsibility for one so young to bear. But Pausanias himself, whose qualities as a general never entirely outpaced his conceit, shouldered it with insouciance. Even so, the brute fact of their general's youth must have kept Thermopylae and Leonidas's death there all the more firmly in the Spartans' minds. Marching to liberate Greece, they were also after revenge. And there were others, too, of course, who wanted payback, men whose losses had been infinitely greater than the Spartans. At Eleusis, 35 miles along the coastal road from the isthmus, Pausanias waited while Aristeides and 8,000 other Athenians ferried themselves across from Salamis. Also joining the expedition were 600 exiles from a second city occupied and torched by the invaders, Plataea. Now, at last, a year after fleeing their homeland, the cherished moment of return had finally arrived. It was time for the Plataeans and for everyone else committed to meeting with the barbarian to take the road to Boeotia. But their beloved homeland was not as they had left it. Their fields were overgrown and their city a blackened shell. Trees for miles around had been levelled. Stripped and raw, the timbers now formed the barbarians' palisade. Meanwhile, the barbarians themselves, their numbers appearing to slur together in the shimmering heat, swarmed across the plain, and everywhere, it seemed, there were horses. There could have been few among the Greeks who didn't feel a tremor of consternation at such a sight. And Pausanias himself, who was arrogant but certainly not foolhardy, had not the slightest intention of crashing down directly to confront the enemy on ground so favourable to their cavalry. Instead, sternly ordering his men to keep to the foothills, he then manoeuvred them into a position roughly opposite Mardonius's forces, not only above, but some 7 miles to the east of Plataea. Yet, though Pausanias was proving himself to be cautious, it is unlikely that his first sight of the Persian forces had prompted anything like the alarm that Mardonius must have experienced when he looked up from the banks of the Asopus and saw the full scale of the army snaking across the foothills above him.